Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I'm talking about elements that on 900 megacycles you would normally build the elements out of a wire that's, you know, 16 gauge, 18 gauge, where the wire is less than a 16th of an inch in diameter, and I'm making the elements not out of wire, I'm making the parasitic elements out of sheet metal, and I'm making the sheet metal 3/4 of an inch wide. That's a huge percentage of width on 900 megacycles. It's a peculiar looking Yagi. It's one great big stamp chunk of sheet metal, by the way. And if you Google the name Canadal, you'll find the patent on that antenna that was just recently issued. And the claim to fame on this particular antenna is it's got a hell of a lot more bandwidth. And with the currently available computer modeling programs, you cannot easily model that antenna. That extra width gives you finite elements or triangles that are so expensive, let me drop, that the program will crash and it can't model that antenna for you. But you tweak it up on a good network analyzer where you're looking at gain and VSWR simultaneously in two colors on a Rode and Schwarz network analyzer, and you're looking at those parameters on the screen simultaneously on a good antenna range, and you're doing the tweaking of the antenna, you can find all kinds of performance you never thought was there. So when you make the element super wide, I'm not substantially changing the Q of the elements per se. Whatever loss they had, if anything, got lower. You would think the Q got higher. But the real Q, the bandwidth of the antenna, is a function of the resistive loading equivalent between the elements. In other words, that director sitting out in front has a certain coupling coefficient back to the driven element that gives it a certain equivalent shunt resistor, which lowers its Q. So you can end up with fancy tuning techniques, very wide elements. You can end up with roughly twice the bandwidth of the antenna and keep essentially the same performance. And did you lower the Q of the elements? Well, if I tested each one of those elements by themselves, the wider elements have lower resistance. If anything, that Q is higher. Yet the antenna is larger in bandwidth because the in-circuit loaded Q between the elements is what's now affecting bandwidth. As you can see, there's more to it than first meets the eye. I wonder if some of that made some sense, Mel. K2KUI, K2LIW.
Okay, now, we're looking at this antenna. Actually, you're looking at the directors, and they look like double Vs. In other words, a V sticking up, and on the top of the diamond, the V sticking down, and it's split like that. So in other words, we got like a double V type of configuration. Now, would this give you a collinear effect stick, which would actually, to some extent, lower the vertical radiation angle? Would we get that effect because we have this element, in other words, a quad foot like this, in other words, a V sticking up and a V sticking down? In that type of configuration, actually, I could double V tick over.
The answer is yes, but only a little bit. If I'm building a two-element quad or a three-element quad, because I've got a inverted V Yagi-like structure on top and a non-inverted V Yagi-like structure on the bottom, I do have two Yagis vertically stacked, vertically separated. That's the good news. The bad news, they're only separated by half a wavelength. And so you get a little bit of performance improvement for two and three element Yagis. By the time you get to 4, 5, 10, or whatever element Yagis, where now if you are vertically stacking Yagis that are longer in boom and many more elements, the number of wavelengths of stacking to get full performance increases. The effective capture area of each individual Yagi is increasing. It's a circle-like structure. And you want those circles not to be of effective capture area, not to be overlapping. So you desire greater stacking distance. And with that quad-like structure or open quad structure, unless you carry it to great big gaps on the end, you don't have the proper stacking distance. You don't get all that increase in performance. So you get a little bit of performance for a small number of elements. For a large number of elements, I say no. Back to you, Mel, K2LIW.
Hey, Roger, very good. Yeah, well, like I say, I've seen that once. They were producing one called the Open Quad, type of element for 144, but I never saw one for 432. So I guess it does exist. Okay, very good. I was just thinking about a number of factors, you know, picturing a quad like that, and I was thinking if there'd be any advantage to, you know, a design of a quad like that, if it worked, you know, on 432, 144, would it be a more effective quad if you, you know, moved it down into, like you were mentioning, the stepper, which I've heard everybody rave. Whoever has one I've talked to said it's the best. They've had other beams. They've stacked beams on their towers and compared them and did everything possible and found that the stepper is the antenna that overall works phenomenal. That's basically what I've heard from so many people, Dick, that have used them. Okay, shall we go on with another one? Over.
Fire when ready.
I'm reading things over here. Let me see. Okay, here's one. I'm picking out that antenna question as usual. Is there a good reason why the loading coil is centrally located in the dipole element? Because I want to put up a compact dipole, space is a problem, and so I'd like to add loading coils in each leg. But for reasons of support and all, how important is it for me to put the loading coil centrally located in each dipole element? Well, there are reasons for it. Let you say the word first. Go ahead.
Yeah, the whole reason you're putting a loading coil on a dipole is because you want to shrink the physical size but keep it resonant. You get the highest performance out of a dipole in bandwidth, not very much difference in gain, but the bandwidth will be the broadest if you make it a full, flat-out dipole. As you start going to inverted V, you give up a little bit of bandwidth. As you start making it physically more compact, by putting loading coils at the bottom, middle, or top, and putting top hat capacitors at the top, and zigzagging the wire, as you do all the things to make it come back to resonance with a smaller physical size, in all cases, the Q goes up, the bandwidth goes down. The efficiency stays the same. The gain, you can't lose more than 3 or 4 tenths of a dB of gain as you go from a full dipole to an infinitesimal dipole, a tenth or a twentieth of a wavelength long. It's a dog of a problem to impedance match an antenna that small. The resistive component goes down to an ohm. The reactive component goes to 2,000 ohms. And it's a dog of a thing to impedance match. But if you impedance match it losslessly, you're within 3 or 4 tenths of a dB of the exact same gain you would have with a full flat-out dipole. Now, so physical length and bandwidth of the dipole are almost a one-to-one relationship. There's a slight variation on that, and that is in the process of shrinking the dipole to shorter sizes, if you put capacitive top hat plates at the tips of the dipole instead of using coils, you end up with a little bit more uniform current along the length of the dipole, and there are people who think that that gives you a little bit more performance in bandwidth, not in gain, but in bandwidth. You have a little bit more linear current. As opposed to putting the load, as you move the loading coil higher or go to the extreme, which is top hat capacitors at the tip of the dipole, you get a little bit more bandwidth. But other than that, the difference of putting the loading coil in the center, or a little bit off to the center, or halfway toward the tip, or three quarters away to the tip, the difference in performance is very small. And it's not in gain. The difference in performance is bandwidth, and it's very slightly different. But you could make yourself a chart for the length of your dipole, which you're resonating, versus bandwidth. Smaller length, smaller bandwidth. That's it. That's physics. Because radiation is hard. The signal doesn't just go onto that wire and then jump into space. That signal you put onto that wire has to bounce back and forth something like 30 times for a full, flat-out dipole before it's finally radiated into space. What I call resonance is where all those 30 bounces stay in phase, stay in step with each other. They don't start leading or lagging. because the electrical length of the dipole is too long or too short. That's what resonance really means. As you make the dipole physically shorter, but do something to re-resonate it, instead of making 30 bounces, it's got to make 50 bounces before that signal finally radiates into space. And it doesn't take 50 bounces and all jump. You know, 150 is that it jumps off into space on each bounce. So it's got to make a larger number of bounces because you've got less area, less real estate when you make it physically smaller. Therefore, you've got to keep a larger number of bounces in step. That's a fancy way of saying you've got a smaller bandwidth. You've got a higher Q. So the Vizsla bandwidth is a more drastic U-shaped, bathtub-shaped curve. And so minor differences as to where you put it, your real choice of how you shrink your dipole is more a function of your smarts in mechanical engineering than it is electrical choice. That's an opinion. It's an opinion based on a fair number of years of antenna tuning. I'm not convinced it's the last word on the subject. I bet you've had some of the guys in the Kings County Radio Club that have experimented with putting loading coils on base-loaded whips and on monopoles and dipoles. And I bet as they put the loading coils in various places, they've also come to opinions. And some of those opinions are going to be different than mine, I think. So go ahead and tell me about those, Mel. K2KUI, K2LIW.
Okay, the conventional thinking, this is K2KUI, the conventional thinking always was that if you take a dipole and you want to add a loading coil and you don't put it a quarter way from the feed point, what'll happen? Well, as you move the coil supposedly closer to the feed point, your coil, yes, will can be less inductive, but the coil will be have a higher current on it, and so the losses will be higher. Now we're thinking theoretically. Is that a good theoretical statement? In other words, coils moving closer to the feed point, higher currents involved, losses will be higher. Correct or not, Dick? Over.
Absolutely correct, but there's a catch. If I pour a cup of water into the Jamaica Bay out in front of your house, does the tide go up in altitude? Absolutely. Does it go up enough to talk about? Not a chance. I said Jamaica Bay, you know, the body of water in front of Manhattan Beach. Does the loss of the coil go up? Without a doubt. But if you were smart enough to make the coil out of a big enough chunk of copper and a high enough quality of copper, with 100 watts into that dipole for 10 solid minutes, that coil runs essentially ice cold to your hand, the difference in loss is so small it ain't worth talking about. If you've got a lossy coil, you haven't used the right materials, in my opinion. You shouldn't be getting loss in that coil. If you decided it's a spring coil that you want to be very strong and springy on the base of a great big whip that you're mounting onto the bumper of an automobile, and you make the spring coil out of high resistance steel, and now you're getting a lot of loss, yeah, what you said is true. In my opinion, you didn't use the right materials. And even there, you can get away with lousy materials if you silver plated or gold plated to make the resistivity of the surface with the skin effect get high enough. So the coil shouldn't get hot if you use the right materials, in my opinion, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I'm just talking theoretically, you know, if we're going to go by classical theory. Okay, what happens if we took the coil and we start moving it to the end? Less current would flow in the coil. What would require, I guess, more current. Would that mean that we're increasing the coil loss? Follow what I'm saying? Theoretically. We're just talking theoretically. Of course, we're talking about, like you say, throwing that cup of water here in the Atlantic Ocean. So, in other words, I'm going to move the coil now, and we're going to move it towards the end. Now, less current is going to flow in the coil, but more currents are going to be required for that particular use of the band. And because of the increasing number of turns, will we be increasing coil loss, Dick? Would that fit theoretically? Over.
Theoretically, yes. But even there, I don't agree with the what appears to be the bottom line, and that is don't put the coil higher up because more turns are going to give you more length of wire and therefore more loss. There is essentially no loss in that coil if you've chosen the right materials. And as you move the coil closer and closer to the end, at first you think it needs more and more turns. As you get it right out to the end, you suddenly realize it's not a coil, it's a top hat capacitor. The whole thing acts as one lump capacitor, and there's very little voltage drop across it when you make it right at the end. So as the coil gets large enough in diameter with enough turns, and you move it right out to the end, it's just a fancy way of building a top hat loading capacitor, in my opinion, that metal grid.
Roger. Yeah, I agree with you. All right. I'm just thinking hypothetically, you know, really what is taking place because this was the question. So if you have to put it like Dick was just saying, we're just talking hypothetically what is actually taking place. So basically, if you take that coil, move it this way or that way, a little bit here and there, it's not going to really make an effect, I'm sure. In fact, Dick says a cup of water into the ocean. Okay, shall we try another one?
Yep. Yes, we have enough. Yes, we have enough time. Go for one more, Mel.
See you. Looking at here. Questions. All right. You once mentioned that you had converted a 6 meters a amplifier. What amplifier was that? How much was it to convert? I converted an amplifier to 6 meters. I'm trying to recall now. Oh, yes. I had one time a friend that wanted a 6 meter amplifier. He had it was a Heathkit SB200. And converted to 6 meters was basically modification of the tank circuit, the plate circuit. That was basically all it wasn't. I think I made a new coil up. I'm trying to recall this. You remember the modification stick to Heathkit SB200 or any of those linear amplifiers for 6 meters that was popular back in the 60s, over?
Yeah, the SB, I'm looking at one right now. It's mine, an SB1000. I think that's the model number. Huh. Can't see the model number on the top thing. But it's a Heathkit amplifier, and they made essentially a 1500 watt version and a 2000 watt version. And each of those, if you're smart enough in the way you modify the tank circuit, adding another a tap point and a set of switches that you flip, so that you redesign the resonator on the input. I believe that's a grounded grid amplifier. You're driving the cathode. So you have a slightly different cathode circuit and a slightly different plate circuit when you're on 6 meters. And it doesn't give you super performance, but it does give you quite a bit of power output. I think you can get close to 1,000 watts output on that thing at 6 meters. There was an article in, I think, but I'm not positive, Ham Radio Magazine, how to do that. I don't think that appeared in QSB. I think it appeared in Ham Radio. And it is doable. When you look at the tube manual for that particular tube and you look at its performance for 6 meters, you know what you're going to get ahead of time. The tank circuit itself, if you use the right materials, it will run low in loss. It will give you an impedance match between that tube and your 50-ohm output connector that goes to your antenna. So input impedance matching, output impedance matching, and insertion loss of those networks, if you're smart enough, that's a given, and you can keep that low. So the real performance you're going to get on 6 meters is strictly between you and that tube manufacturer, and you can find out what that tube is going to do by looking at the appropriate tube manual. And so if you like 6 meters and a kilowatt of power, that's probably worth doing. A number of people have done it, and I think successfully. And I'm trying to think of the guy's call that is right now on Long Island who's a real 6 meter expert. WA2AN something. I just went to a lecture of his at the Suffolk County Radio Club, Radio Central Radio Club, 2 weeks ago. How short my memory is. Anyhow, it'll come to me in a minute. I'll have to look him up. Anyhow, if we ask him that question, and he keeps records of everybody's favorite antenna and favorite amplifier on 6 meters, we'll find out pretty much what performance you're going to get ahead of time. But the true manual, I think, is going to tell it to you. K2KE1, K2LIW.
Roger, yeah, the SP200, that was the Eastgate amplifier now. I've gotten to recall, had a pair of 572s in it, which known as 811. And I remember, it's not a heck of a big modification. Basically, I remember I made up a new coil for it out of piece of copper. In fact, the piece of air conditioning, copper tubing, 3/16, I think they call it 3/16 copper tubing, that they used in air conditioning system. And I wound a few turns to that. I remember I had to put in a couple of variable capacitors, variables, and some parasitic suppressors I added. It was like a fairly easy modification. And what was the final result? Yes, gave me, let's see, gave me on 6 meters. I think my friend says it was doing quite well, at least somewhere in the neighborhood of about 750 watts or so, or something in that neighborhood. So it's very simple to do. I don't remember if it was published. Dick says it was published in one of the magazines, the step-by-step system of how to do it, but I don't recall it offhand. But I know it did work quite well, Doug. Really, if you have the amplifier, you pick them up at Hamfest, and then you find it very cheap. And you want to get on 6 meters, have a little power on 6 meters, I think is an excellent way to go. You can do the conversion over very fast. Very little work has to be done, Dick, over.
Yeah, that is a nice way of building a high-power amplifier. Back in the mid-60s, I built myself a half-kilowatt power amplifier for 6 meters out of a 4CX250B tube. Run as a tetrode, running grounded cathode service, driven on the grid, and output from the plate circuit. And I was putting 2,000 volts on the plate. I don't know what current it drew, and I think its output was in the 500-600 watt category. I was only driving it with 1 watt. I was using a transistorized driver. I was a little shy on drive power. And this was Class C service. I think I had in the vicinity of 500 watts of output. So there are ways of building some pretty nice high power amplifiers. As you get to the kilowatt level, I'm convinced a tube is a nicer way to go than transistorized. But that's an opinion. The tube circuit is very forgiving. It's very easy to change the mode of operation from linear to Class C to Class B, AB1, AB2, whatever, by simply changing the drive, bias on the control grid, and or voltage on the screen grid, and reloading the tuning and loading controls on the plate circuit. You can go from any mode to any other mode that you like. The amplifier has got lots of reserve dissipation, can tolerate a open circuit or a short circuit for a period of time without damaging itself, and transistorized amplifiers at the kilowatt level cannot do that in general. You take the average transistorized amplifier and forget to connect the antenna by mistake. Let me drop. And if you don't have a very fast microsecond response time safety circuit built into the amplifier, you can wipe out an awful lot of silicon in a hurry. And a kilowatt value, kilowatt level of power supply for a solid-state amplifier on any frequency is a very difficult problem. So the power supply is difficult, the amplifier is difficult, the gain is low, it's persnickety, and you need a lot more stages, it's more narrowband. Solid-state at the kilowatt level is a bit of a problem, in my opinion. That's the place where tubes still shine, and here we are, you know, 40 years into the solid-state world, but still there are very few solid-state equivalents that are nice and easy to use at the kilowatt and beyond level. You talk to every one of the guys that are doing serious moon bounce on 2 meters, 6 meters, 432 and up. I think you'll find that 96% of them are all using tubes. Okay, I'm going to start signing off. This was TechNet number 1175. Of the series of TechNets that began in September of 1982. You guys have spent some of your life listening to this jazz. You go to the website of amateurradio.tv, and you can listen to all the past shows of Mel and Dick with all of our ham radio opinions and the ham radio opinions of our friends who sign in. 73, you're all behind to each other. And Mel, back to you. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Dick, I got a quick question for you. Very fast question. W2EWK.
Go ahead, Eugene.
Okay, I was just thinking, you know, when I was sitting there on my new bed, I was thinking of a dog whistle. And how you turn on a repeater is that you get a dog whistle and tune it to a certain frequency, and that would actually turn on a repeater. Do you remember those olden days, the golden days of ham radio with the old Motorola radio?
Yeah, that can definitely work. Along those lines, Eugene, the high school kids, for quite some time now, have been getting cell phone calls in the classroom, and the teacher doesn't know it. They tune their cell phones in such a way that it doesn't vibrate, it doesn't ring a bell, it gives a 15 kilohertz note. A person with young ears can easily hear the 15 kilohertz note. If a teacher is beyond 30 years of age, she does not hear the 15 kc note and does not know the cell phone is ringing. So ultrasonics and ear ultrasonics, you can have a lot of fun with it. Back to you, Eugene.
Okay, Dick, that's the only thing I want to point out. And I still got my dog whistle, and I can still hear it, you know, mighty fine over here. I don't know about you, but I can still hear it. And I don't know, I don't think there's any more repeaters like that anymore. But that's the golden days. Okay, W2EWK clear.
The Sylvania Television Center, I think it was Sylvania, or was it Magnavox? Anyhow, in the mid-50s, the remote control was a small metal rod with a little hammer inside. You press the button and instruct the hammer to make the channels go up and down and make the volume go up and down. What brand name was that?
The Zenith hand unit. All the Zenith hand units, the remote controls that they had were all that put a tuning fork in it over.
That's the one, Zenith, and so they used ultrasonics to run the remote control. And every so often somebody would run a paint can, a compressed paint can, and they didn't know it, but the little spray nozzle was also putting out an ultrasonic signal and changing everybody's channel in the building. 73, you all. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. Had a lot of problems with that. I remember a number of them that I used to turn the gain down. Because people come home and hear voices in their apartment and think that there's burglars in the apartment. The TV set had turned itself on by picking up some kind of sound somewhere. And just a little too sensitive, because a lot of hand units, you can take and go in and literally down the other end of the apartment and strike, you know, push the button on the hand unit and change the channels or change the volume or turn the set on and all. So you turn it down, the gain. And make it so that it would only work in that room to prevent that problem. But for many years, Zenith used that system. And in fact, the last of their remote controls, they just converted, instead of using that strike bar, they went to an ultrasonic hand unit and generated the frequencies electronically and into a transducer, Dick, over.
Now, it turns out that in the United Kingdom, there are a large number of societies that study and love bats. And each bat has his own ultrasonic frequency that he does his acoustic radar system with. So each brand of bats has his own frequency and way of chirping. And you can buy ultrasonic receivers that will take the high frequency audio at 20, 30, 40, 50, 80, 100 kc, beat it down to a lower frequency, either by heterodyning or frequency dividing, and now you make the bat sounds acoustic so that a human ear can hear them. And there are people who are buying these kits and buying these completely made circuits, and they go out in the field where their favorite bat is, and they listen to those sounds and say, aha, I know how many bats are flying by today, I know what their health is, and they like listening to the bat sounds by bringing the ultrasonics back down. And they like identifying, each bat has got his own characteristic way he runs his acoustic radar when he's flying around. So you can have a lot of fun by listening to ultrasonics. There also is a device called Key Ringer, K-E-Y-R-I-N-G-E-R, which are, you put this device on your keys, you put a similar one in your pocket, you press the button, it sends out an ultrasonic sound, and then when 300 feet, it turns on the remote device that flashes its light and starts beeping its horn, and it says, here I am, here's your keys. Within 300 feet, you can find your keys. K-2-K-E-Y, K-2-R-I-W. That thing costs $29, by the way.
Roger, roger. Yeah, very good. Yeah, well, I had a gadget many years ago that basically was called, listen to the bugs in your backyard, and all, they give off ultrasonic sounds to bugs and things, and that's basically what it was. It had a transducer, a little transducer mic on it, and it converted it down so that you could hear the sounds, all kinds of sounds that these bugs make, and all up in the, I don't know, all the way up in frequency, gee. 20, 35 kilohertz. So, yeah, it was a nice little gadget. No, I remember putting it together. It was an article, one of the magazines on it. All right, very good, Dick. With that, good night to you. Good night to all. Thank you very much, everyone, for joining us. And we'll try to do it again next week, please. Again, the emails, I have to skip over a lot of them. I cannot comment on this, nor can I also read some of these. Want to send me a number of questions that we'll go over some of these things and look over PhD pieces and everything. I review it. I'm afraid we're just not in that situation. So if you just please keep it. Again, also quote from stocks and things, investments. Not in that. It'll have to be in the realm of amateur radio basic electronics, because I see a number of these peak comments there. So, with that, 73 is all. Good night. Take care. We'll hope to do it again next week. This is K2KEY. Any final words, Dick?
K2L.
Who was that?
Dick, this is Bernie, K2YO. Just a quick question. Any chance either one of you going to be at the Limar Camfest next week? It'd be nice to do an eyeball with you, so.
Yeah, I think I'm going to be there. I give it about an 80% chance. How about you, Mel?
Okay, you're going to be there. I'll make an effort to see if I can make it also, Dick.
Now, there's still a little bit of a problem of intercepting each other. I may go there at 11 o'clock in the morning and only be there for an hour or something like that. I'm not sure. I know that Andy wants me to meet a friend of his, so maybe this time I'll come a little bit earlier. I'll try. No guarantee. Every so often something comes up on Sunday. My crazy consulting business, every so often people think they can only get a hold of me on Sunday. Okay, Mr. Wyo, you got it.
Oh, that was it. Just would be great to see you guys. We hear your voice all the time. It'd be wonderful to kind of put a face to it. So, anyway, 73 is K2YO, Chris.
Yeah, Mel is the one that's, he's got blonde hair, blue eyes, he's around 6 foot tall. About 160 pounds and all muscle. Isn't that close, Mel?
Okay, when I see you, make sure I treat you to something. For that stick, I guarantee I'm going to give you something real good.
Uh-oh, that sounds scary. Okay, bye-bye, you all.